This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio for the weekend of the 20th and 21st of February. This week we have all the regulars, plus, can computers run our world better than bankers and politicians? That was a casual question a few weeks ago. We quizzed the Bristol Zeitgeist movement further on this subject. We hope to interview Kerry McCarthy, the Labour member for Bristol East, live from Westminster later in the show. And we hear from a victim of Masonic corruption, and he reveals their secret handshakes. Anthony Page has been listening to Bristol's up-and-coming young public speakers. We also have some rustic reminiscences, reporter Tony Ozing reporting on the right to roam. Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio, Sean and Baba. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
You're from the Zeitgeist movement.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. And you're also sort of part of the Venus Project as well. So tell me a little bit about what the difference is and what they are.
Well, the Venus Project is a vision of Jacques Fresco. He's 92 years old. He's spent almost his entire lifetime developing ideas about how the world can run more efficiently, more economically, in fact, without an economy. In fact, Zeitgeist movement started with Peter Joseph, mm-hmm. and he started with the myths in society, all the illusions, all the deceptions that are out there, like the monetary system, 9/11, and religion, and a lot of structures that are in place to implement control over the society.
Okay.
Then
he was influenced by Jacques Fresco.
Basically, the two realized that actually their visions are very similar.
Right.
And they have come together, and Zeitgeist has become the activist arm of the Venus Project.
Okay.
So the Zeitgeist is actually raising awareness throughout the world about the possibilities of how humanity can evolve into the future, which is where the Venus Project comes in.
Right. I mean, Sean, tell me, 9/11, you say, sort of triggered questions, which then led you to the topic of monetary reform. I mean, what was your first reaction when you first heard about 9/11, and did you have any opinions about the political system beforehand, or...?
Well, 9/11 itself didn't really bring about any questions towards the political system. It was just a shocking thing. I think a lot of people felt the same. I didn't really establish any opinions on it directly until I did a bit of research. And the initial research that I did was, I stumbled across Zeitgeist and then started watching other films such as the, what's the infamous one called again?
Loose Change.
And after Zeitgeist, it kind of made me realize that it's not necessarily a case of who did it. It's more a case of what we're being told isn't necessarily what actually occurred. It seems as though physics itself was out of place. When a plane hits the top of a building, it shouldn't really fall to the floor. There was a steel structure in place that shouldn't have allowed that to happen. Also, the third building, the fact that it wasn't even mentioned by the American government. I mean, these things really make you question, and it kind of becomes a myth, and then you start to wonder sort of history itself, what areas have been taught in ways that aren't necessarily true. What is history and what is past? They're two very different things. And
I think it was Napoleon, I think you said, the history is a story agreed upon by the winners. So that sort of encapsulates your...
That's very much true, but in the same sense, that history is created by someone, and that person's influences... given to him from society also render his manner at which he distributes the information. So if he's happy about what happened, he's going to apply happy words into that information.
Okay.
So society really does create everything, and that's kind of one of the fundamental realizations of the Zeitgeist movement.
Okay, so bearing in mind that we've covered that your vision of history, as you're being told, is not fully what you think is really going on, how does this bear on monetary reform and the money system, and how these two are sort of connected in your mind?
Well, the monetary system is based on the fractional reserve system. If you watch the Zeitgeist Addendum, which is the second in the series of Zeitgeist movies, mm-hmm. it really breaks it down how money is created from debt, basically, and it's just a pile of debt on debt on debt. We know for a fact in the UK, 97% of the money is electronic, only 3% is physical.
Right.
And the banks throughout the world, they have they copy the same system as the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, which is a private bank, not even a public bank, and the money is generated by borrowing money from private bankers, and this on based on $1 of debt, you can actually loan out $9.
Yeah. So I mean, legislation has been suggested worldwide that's being supported by Obama and Gordon Brown to suggest, well, if you separate capital banking and public banking like high street banks, mm-hmm. surely, you know, but that should sort things out.
A system's not being considered that's separate from the system we're using today. This is the thing. Politics isn't there to change things, which is what they advertise. They're there to keep things exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that as long as you have a monetary system, you're going to continue to have the things that monetary systems create.
Right.
And as profit equals scarcity mm-hmm. and problems also equal profit, then you end up with a system that can only corrupt itself.
Okay, so I mean, money originally evolved because as an answer to supply and demand and how to dish out scarce resources. So what do you suggest?
A technological system.
Yeah, basically the idea is the resource-based economy. So in that, what happens is you start with all the resources of the world, mm-hmm. pool them all together, and allocate them efficiently and in the most appropriate manner. So basically, there's no scarcity or excess anywhere. All is distributed equally. And if there is a lack somewhere, and if there's an excess somewhere else, you know, automatically the excess flows to the scarcity.
So who runs this computer system? I mean, surely that's encouraging centralization. Some kind of body is going to have to run this computer system.
Well, once the system's in place, there's really no need for someone to run it. It can run itself. I mean, what's the easiest way to explain this? Let's take forks, for example. If you want forks, people want forks to eat. It's what they're used to. What are forks made out of? Okay, if you want something to last a long period of time, then maybe you choose the most sustainable material. But what's the point in having a titanium fork? You may as well have a material that's more tangible, more useful, and can last the period of time. And there's enough of it to allow for sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, every individual subject has an individual approach. So.
Okay. But isn't this just replacing democracy with a form of technocracy? I mean, computers are only good as the people that have programmed them. Surely this
but there's no money system, so you can't have differential advantage. You can't have socio-economical advantage over one another. I mean, that entire culture would disappear. Everyone would be seen as an equal. The resource-based economy is literally giving the resources of the earth to man.
Yeah. Can I just add something? Basically, it's somewhat like each local community will have its own power to make its own decisions rather than referring back to a central government.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, people would come together and contribute to decision-making and actually agree on it all together.
Right.
Obviously, the computers will be there to, you know, provide solutions.
And okay. You also have to define what is necessary for a computer to decide upon and for a human to decide upon, because I mean, this is obviously a huge subject, but is it at the moment in our system, do you decide upon a bridge that's put over a river? I mm-hmm. mean, so what is the purpose of the bridge? What should the bridge be made out of?
Okay. You know, I mean, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you a little bit short there, and we'll have to return to this in future weeks, because this is a sort of a huge topic. Which is why I've got you in for a second time. You've already been here once before, as eagle-eared listeners will have spotted. But the Venus Project and the Zeitgeist Movement, how can people find out more?
The Zeitgeist Movement UK.com or Zeitgeist, just Google Zeitgeist, I guess.
Google Zeitgeist, okay, that's a short answer.
I think the easiest way, there's a free film on the internet called Zeitgeist Addendum. If you have any questions at all, then email us on bzm at live.co.uk and we can answer any questions.
Okay, well, Sean and Baba, thank you very much for coming in. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you.
In the previous weeks, you will have heard a lot of stuff to do with the Gaza Convoy, which is the charity aid convoy, whose aim was to get into Gaza and provide aid. However, we have news from somebody who was actually inside Gaza and her experiences of being an ambulance driver, and I'd like to introduce her on the telephone now. Sharon Locke, hello.
Hello.
You're a human rights activist and you spent some time in Gaza. Tell me a little bit about what you were doing and how you got there.
Okay, well, I was part of a project called the Free Gaza Project to take boats through to Gaza. Gaza's been under siege by Israel for a couple of years, so there ain't any easy way in or out. And we decided to try the sea route, and we got two fishing boats through and got to Gaza in August 23 in 2008. And a small number of us stayed on to volunteer under the banner of the International Solidarity Movement, which was started some years ago by Israelis and Palestinians working together.
Yeah.
While I was there, I initially started accompanying fishermen as they went out in their fishing boats, because while they fish in the Gaza Sea, they're shot at by Israeli gunboats, so it's very dangerous work.
So you're putting yourself at great risk here as well, I imagine.
Yeah, obviously. But, you know, I'm not that... I mean, children in Gaza are facing bullets on a regular basis, so I kind of can't really obsess too much about myself under those circumstances.
Okay.
But, I mean, we didn't... At that stage, we really didn't know what was coming, because I did then end up there when the Israeli attacks began on December 27th, 2008, which then went on for 22 days, and during that time we were riding with ambulances, a lot of it.
What nature did those attacks take, and sort of how were you affected right in the middle of it? What was happening?
Well, Gaza's a really tiny area, and it's got 1.5 million people in it, and 50% of them are under 18. So basically, half the population were kids, and they, you know, they and all of us were facing, first of all, bombing from the air and sea. In the first 10 minutes of the attacks, Israel wiped out half the civil defense bases, which are basically the ambulances and firefighters, so that was kind of a tactical, quite grim move.
Yeah.
During that time, I was then riding with the ambulances, and a couple of days after that, the land invasion began, so we had tanks coming in. And I was riding with the Red Crescent ambulances and documenting attacks on civilians, because the overwhelming majority of people injured were in the thousands.
Right. And how did you document that?
Well, we were just making it up as we went along, to be honest, because there were very few international organizations having representatives in there at the time. People had gone out for Christmas. Israel hadn't let them back in. And so we were just taking notes, taking photos with our own, you know, quite cheap cameras that we bought.
Yeah.
And I was writing a blog, which is how the book came about, because I was trying to upload every day everything that I saw and witnessed. And I thought, you know, this is important that people see what's going on, because I don't know how much the outside world knows of what's happening.
So, okay, well, when you got back, I mean, how, you presumably looked into sort of what impact that your blog and your activities had. What impact did you find that the media, you know, did the media take a lot of interest in what you had seen?
Well, it was, yes and no, I'd say to that, really, because, I mean, when I first started the blog, which was a week before the attacks began, I was mainly thinking it was for my friends and my parents and, you know, but sort of because the attacks then began, and obviously I think there are lots of people now who don't feel that the mainstream media gives them the full story. You know, maybe they just get a 2-minute soundbite, so they go looking on the internet. People were Googling, I think, and coming up with, you know, reports in English from me. Obviously there are many Arabic people writing for the websites as well, but so my readers sort of went up to thousands really suddenly. And I was getting called by a lot of media for interviews. I mean, there were 7 or 8 of us, as I say, from our particular organization.
Yeah.
We were all getting phoned a lot from various countries.
Right,
but I
okay.
mean, it was still quite limited. For example, the only time I think I gave regular BBC interviews was sort of, would have been 3 a.m. here. You know, it was like, here's Sharon live from Gaza, but everyone in England was probably asleep and not listening. So,
yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this book. And so this is published, it's going to be published right now, or is it?
It's out now. It's in the bookshops, or it will be if you order it anyway.
Okay.
It's been brought out by Palito Press, and you can buy it directly from their website. But I'm also going to be at the Eastern Community Centre in Bristol on the 27th of February in the evening, and I'm bringing copies to sell. And I think we're having a fundraiser gig afterwards at the pub across the road, so we'll sort of have a tea and cake version of things, and then a music and dancing version of things.
And what is the book called?
Gaza Beneath the Bombs.
Gaza Beneath the Bombs by Sharon Locke. Okay.
You can have a look at my website for more details, which is talestotell.wordpress.com.
Talestotell.wordpress.com, and that's where you can go to look up more information. Sharon Locke, thank you very much for telling us about your book at rather short notice. And if you go to a search engine or go to Sharon Locke's website and look up the event, you'll be able to find more details about it. But it's at the Eastern Community Centre on the 27th of February. And Sharon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our reporter Anthea Page was at the Hilton last week for the BPW UK Public Speaking Competition, and that involved pupils from local schools.
Sylvia Perry.
Can you tell us about the competition this evening?
Yes, it's a very long time that we've been running this competition, Business and Professional Women UK. It is really to build confidence of young people and to improve their communication skills, presentation in public and so forth. The competition itself is a team of three presenting a public meeting with a chairman, a speaker and someone who expresses thanks. They have 15 minutes and they take a topic of current affairs, something of national importance, because although this competition starts locally, it goes on to a regional aspect and then to a national final, which will be in March.
So how important do you think this is generally to the people in their careers?
I think it's a basic thing one needs to have now. You have to have public speaking in various guises, whether you're standing up and making a presentation or you're doing it around a committee board table. Everybody has an area where they have to have good verbal skills. We've had some interesting people in our competition in years gone by. I remember Carol Vorderman wasn't a winner, but she was in one time in the competition. And we've had people who've gone on to be MPs, teachers in business and barristers, all sorts of things. So throughout the years, it's been delightful to see the young people when they've given their ambitions of what they want to be in life and why they're practicing their skills actually succeed in later life. And I have been the national president of Business and Professional Women in the UK, the European coordinator, and then for 3.5 years I was the international president. I'm still internationally involved. I chair their history and archive committee on the international organisation, and I also am the international trustee. And in 2 weeks' time I'm going to New York to go to the Commission Status of Women at the United Nations, because it's 15 years since Beijing. Now, we went to the Fourth World Conference of Women, 30,000 of us, and that's something to celebrate. It set up a wonderful sisterhood, and we actually came away with the slogan of human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights really stamped on our consciousness.
Judith Lee. I'm a priest at French Aid Parish Church in Stapleton. I am a retired teacher, and I think that's why I've been invited to, over the years, to be one of the judges of the public speaking competition.
What about the themes of the competition? Can you tell us a bit about those?
Well, tonight, one of the teams are going to be talking, their title is Vanity Fair. Another team are going to be talking about techno slaves. And another team are going to be talking about The Hand of History. So they're interesting titles. You're not absolutely sure what it's going to be about, but all will be revealed. The other thing that's always very impressive is that the speaker has to be open to answering questions from the audience. And, of course, those questions can come from schools other than their own, and sometimes are quite challenging and sometimes quite tricky. So that's very impressive, again, to hear how they manage those questions and how they handle themselves and handle the subject so well.
I'm Pippa Lyons-White.
And you're a teacher?
Yes, I'm head of Key Stage 4 at Key Stage 4 English at Colson's Girls School.
Can you tell us a bit about the preparation that went into the competition?
We've been working with the six girls involved in the competition. We've been putting in rehearsal times during free periods, lunch times, break times, form times, after school, whenever we can possibly grab some time to actually keep looking at techniques and the content of their speech as well.
And what difference do you think it makes to the girls' confidence?
Enormous. Without a shadow of a doubt, it fills them with confidence. The adrenaline rush they get as a result of today and the confidence that it gives them being able to stand in front of a lot of people they don't know and really put themselves up for judgment, it makes a huge impact on their confidence. They always come away feeling much happier about speaking publicly.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Laura Britton and I'm going to be the expressor of thanks.
Hello, I'm Emma Mullen and I will be the chair this evening.
Hi, I'm Ellie King and I'll be the speaker.
And what's your subject?
Beauty.
I'm Holly Kilpatrick. I'm expressor of thanks for Colston's.
Hi, I'm Sinead McCarthy, and I'm the speaker today.
Good evening, I'm Ajaira Thomas Hill, and I am your chair for this evening.
So, have any of you done this before in the competition?
Me and Jenny have, but Holly's new to this.
I'm a newbie. I haven't done it before.
Are you nervous?
Yeah. But, I mean, if I wasn't, I'd be a bit worried, so.
What about this team? Have any of you done this competition before?
No.
Haven't done anything really
not at all.
No.
So
it's quite exciting.
Adrenaline rush at the moment.
So how has it helped your confidence?
Well, when we've been practising, it's really good, you know, to speak in front of, you know, people, yeah. Friends, but it's going to be different speaking against people we don't know, so that's going to be quite scary.
I think it's also going to be really useful for interviews for university and things like that to really kind of get our confidence up.
Just think it's general confidence building, very, like, beneficial, and it's just really exciting.
You're a mum?
Yes.
And your daughter's?
Laura Britton.
Okay, and is it the first time you've been here for the competition?
It is, yes. No, I'm looking forward to it, to hear all the girls speak and to see how they get on and obviously to hear what QEH have to say as well.
So do you think it's a good idea?
I think it's an excellent idea, because if they go into business, they're going to have to do presentations and give speeches, and this is a good introduction to it.
My name is Joseph Martin.
And which school are you from?
We're from QEH School in Bristol.
And is this your first time at the competition?
No, the boys have performed here over the years. So it's the first time that these two have performed here, but we're regular competitors in this particular competition. We won it last year.
Oh, well done. So, what's your topic this evening?
Charlie this evening is going to speak on a topic, the title of which is The Hand of History. So he's going to be discussing the influence of history, or otherwise, on current events.
Interesting subject. And what do you think about these sort of competitions?
I think it gives young people a terrific opportunity to develop all sorts of skills that they're going to need later in their lives in terms of presenting themselves and presenting complicated ideas and thinking on their feet. And these are all things which will stand them in good stead further down the track.
Hello.
What's your name?
George Bamber.
And what role are you playing tonight?
I'm the vote of thanks.
Yeah. Have you done this before?
I've not actually. Well, I've done similar competitions, but never the vote of thanks, so new experience.
What about you? What's your name?
Charlie Kenber.
What's your role this evening?
I'm speaking on The Hand of History.
Have you done a lot of public speaking?
I've done similar competitions as well, yeah, same as George, but not this exact one, so slightly different format to what I've done before. Should be interesting.
So what's the difference between doing this and, say, acting?
I think in acting, although the words are important to be heard, I think in public speaking you're setting out an argument, and it's important that people follow your train of thought and your thread, and at the end can remember what you've been talking about.
And do you think this will be important in your career?
I think it's very useful, yeah. I think whenever you're doing... I mean, some cousins of mine are doing some job applications at the moment and they're having to do kind of day workshops, talking to partners, etc., in a very similar way to this. So, yeah, I think it'll be very helpful for the rest of my life.
My name's Sue Holtham. I'm the BPW Bristol contact. And whoever wins here this evening at the heat of the public speaking competition will go through to our national final in Oswestry on the 27th of March, and that's held in conjunction with the English Speaking Board. So we're all very excited that they're going to be representing the whole of the region. So that's we're very excited about how it's going to turn out.
That was Anthea Page at the Hilton last week for the BPW UK Public Speaking Competition, which involved pupils from local schools. Okay, well, I'd like to introduce Karen McCarthy on the line now. Hello.
Hello.
So, do you think that you're going to win again in the next election when it's coming up?
Do you mean Labour or in Bristol East or both?
Well, I mean Bristol East and you specifically.
Well, I mean, we're certainly not taking anything for granted. I've been out campaigning a lot throughout in the freezing cold for the last few weekends and just trying to meet as many people as possible. I would hope that the fact that I've represented the area for 5 years and, you know, done a lot of individual casework, met a lot of people, responded to a lot of correspondence and generally worked hard. Well, you know, I'd hope that people would respect that and vote me in again, but you can never be too sure with politics, so you have to make sure that you don't take anything for granted.
I mean, Labour has been slowly losing its grip on Bristol. It's lost the council to the Liberal Democrats. I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, I think with Liberal Democrats tend to do quite well in local elections when, as a protest vote, as much as anything. Mm-hmm. And because Labour's been in government for the last 12, 13 years, sadly, a lot of people, I think, vote in midterm elections, so the European elections in particular, but sometimes in local elections, as a protest vote against the government, rather than because of what they actually want to see happening locally.
Right.
And Bristol, to be fair, you know, there's been... there hasn't been one party that has dominated Bristol politics for quite some time. It's always seems to be like a coalition and the equivalent of hung parliaments and people doing deals and trying to run minority administrations, which I don't actually think is very good for the city. I think we do need, you know, clear direction from whichever party's in charge.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to many people like Labour are going to lose the next election and the Conservatives are going to be in charge. Quite aside from the fact they've been in Parliament for a very long time, what do you think they could really offer people, you know, particularly people standing in Bristol, that might get them to change their minds?
Well, I think the most important issue, and I think people's minds will really focus on this as we get closer to the election, is the economy. And, you know, on that, there's a very, very clear difference between what the Conservative Party is offering, which is swinging cuts and no protection for public services, and not supporting this idea that the role of the state should be to help people in difficult times. So, I'd say, you know, Labour's stance is very much that we wouldn't have got through this recession. You know, it's been tough for people, but it would have been even worse. And people were predicting 5 million unemployed, you know, and it would have been worse if the government hadn't taken action by trying to inject money into the economy, trying to protect people's houses, people's jobs. And we're not out of the woods yet, you know. We've just very slightly moved out of recession, but all that could be jeopardised if you don't have a government that is actually very serious about protecting people.
Yeah, I mean, we've also got the war is a big issue, especially coming up to the election. There's a military surge in Helmand, which Labour is behind, and innocent people are sort of getting killed there at the moment. I mean, is Afghanistan really a vote winner, or is that making a terror attack in the UK more likely?
No, I don't think it is making a terror attack in the UK more likely. If I had to point to the one overseas issue that has been a radicalising feature, you know, way before the Iraq War, it would be the situation in the Middle East. And I would love to see more progress being made there with the Israel-Palestine conflict, because I know certainly when there was a conflict between Israel and Lebanon, but then the Israeli incursion into Gaza, local constituents there were very, very unhappy about that. The Secretary of State for International Development come down to one of the mosques to talk to people. That's actually been a far bigger issue with my constituents than Afghanistan. I don't really get that many people contact me about Afghanistan, except to sort of worry about the safety of the troops and making sure they're equipped properly, more those sort of issues rather than the other.
And you've raised the issue of the Middle East there. I mean, Tony Blair now is a peace envoy for the Middle East. I mean, do you find that is maybe hypocritical, bearing in mind his role in beginning the Iraq War?
Well, he wouldn't have been my choice for the job, put it that way. I think he's got superb negotiating skills. You know, if you see what he actually did in Northern Ireland, there's no doubt that he is good in that sort of situation. He's good at bringing people together.
Yeah.
But, you know, he obviously came to it with a certain amount of baggage because of the Iraq War.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, I would have liked to have seen a more neutral figure.
OK, I mean, we haven't got too much time, so I better move on. But tell me, you're the government's Twitter czar. That's a strange mixture of two words. Tell me, what is a Twitter czar?
It's not a government post. It's a Labour Party thing, so it's party political rather than sort of ministerial or whatever. And it's just that I'm the spokesperson on all new media stuff. So we're doing a lot of social media campaigning. You might have seen some of the sort of viral sites that are doing the rounds with these Tory posters, which aren't actually Labour Party, but they're the sort of thing that the media would come to me for comment on. We're doing a lot with things like virtual phone banks, where people can telephone canvas from their own homes and sort of quite techie stuff. So, but it just got dubbed the Twitter czar pretty quickly.
Right, okay. I mean, social networking hopefully is aimed to increase turnout, but that might work against you. What would you say to that? You might get it in the neck afterwards if you lose the election.
You mean if I'll get blamed if Twitter doesn't deliver the election?
Yeah.
No, I mean, what I think is really important about new media is, and all the social sites, is it allows people to see what politicians are really like. And sometimes that can be a bad thing, sometimes obviously it can be a good thing. But I like the fact that there's a lot of people on Twitter that now feel that they've got a relationship with me, and they know a bit more about me than what you might see if you only sort of saw the going through the official
channel. I mean, how many people follow you on Twitter?
I've just passed the 5,000 mark.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they're not, you know, there are quite a lot of Bristol people on there, but they're not by any means local, but that doesn't particularly bother me because, you know, to me, it's important to talk to people wherever you can reach them.
Right. I mean, you've done incredibly well rising up the Labour ranks. I mean, you only came in at the last election, I understand, and you seem to be doing pretty well. I mean, what are the reasons for that, do you think, possibly?
what a thief of it. No, I've been in Parliament 5 years. I spent the first 2 years on the Treasury Select Committee because I had a bit of a background in financial and legal issues.
Okay.
Then I was 2 years parliamentary aide to the Secretary of State for International Development, and now I'm in the Whip's office. So it's been a sort of fairly gradual process, but I think what it comes down to really is there's been a few issues that I've worked very hard on, and child poverty was one of them.
Okay.
International development was another, and then you get a bit of a reputation for being serious about those issues.
All right, well, if you've got one thing to say to the voters out there, you know, why should we vote for Kerry McCarthy in Labour in your Bristol East constituency, what would you say to them in one sentence?
Well, I think the important thing is they vote full stop. I, you know, the turnout is incredibly important, and they'd be the people that I would really appeal to, that don't assume that your vote doesn't matter. It's going to be a very tight race, and nationally as well as locally, and every vote counts, and you've seen me in action for 5 years, and hopefully on the basis of that you'll think it'd be good to have another 4 or 5 years.
All right. Well, Kerry McCarthy, thank you very much for your time and taking time to speak to me, and best of luck for the future.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Eagle-eared listeners may have noticed last week's edition of Head Trimmings, voiced by the excellent Malcolm Greaves, set in Wiltshire, dealt with the thorny issue of trespassing. What are the rights of landowners, and how can you go for a pleasant walk in the countryside without being harassed? Anyway, our dialect's Tony Gosling has studied the topic of land rights, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hi, John.
So, who right now is really fighting for rights?
Well, it's all sorts of people. I mean, we had an event in Bristol about 10 years ago, for example, up Black Boy Hill, where a piece of derelict land was enclosed, that is to say, fences put up around it by a solicitor who was hoping to claim the land and build a house on it. And literally a year before he was able to claim the land, a whole bunch of people got together to actually take down his hoardings, and that is now called Easter Garden. It's a small public park. So there's lots of land out and about there that maybe the owners have died, disappeared, the deeds have been lost, and that is being grabbed up often by solicitors.
Okay, now going way back, before land began to be privatised by people, we used the medieval open field system. So what was that?
The open field system was essentially the way that communities naturally settled hunter-gatherers would come back to the same piece of land to plant their crops again and again, and then eventually would start building houses. And that's how land was settled, which was a crop rotation system, usually with three fields where crops were rotated each year. So each year one of the fields would be fallow and the other two would be growing food. And the two main crops were wheat for bread and barley for beer. And there was obviously pasture land and other things as well. But that was essentially a completely shared system where you would have a lord of the manor, but everybody would share the fields. So the crop rotation system happened within the three main fields, but also the plots within those fields were also rotated like small allotments.
I mean, most people live in cities nowadays, so, I mean, that inevitably is going to be a bit outdated. So, you know, how did the privatisation of land start?
Well,
the
reason people live in cities nowadays, Britain was the first country, as part of the agricultural and industrial revolution, it was the first country in the world to go for real mass urbanisation. So what we did is we privatised much of our the open field system, the arable land, and those people were then evicted. So they had nowhere to go. So they used to go to the cities to find work in a factory or to get money to buy food rather than to grow it themselves.
Okay, so how was land privatisation affected by the English Civil War in the 1640s?
Well, the Civil War was very important because Charles I, he was beheaded at the end of the Civil War, but he, just before the English Civil War, imposed what are called compositions, which are a form of fine, on the landowners that had been enclosing their land, that is to say, privatising their land. He said, unless they allow the people back onto the land, that I will fine them. And this is one of the reasons that there was so much anger in the late 1630s, early 1640s, was that these merchant classes, big farmers, were forced to pay fines to the king for something that they'd done 2 or 3 years ago, enclosed their land 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
And it was a retrospective, much like this MP's expenses scandal.
Yeah.
MPs are being told to pay back money, even though when they had that money in the first place, the fees office agreed to it. So a retrospective fine does make people angry. And I think it this does, is one of the reasons why the Civil War happened.
And what is a common? Is it owned in common? And are these common now?
Well, no, they're usually owned by a specific landowner, but the common is where people have common rights. That is to say, you have the right to walk there, right to graze, say, 3 cows. And often people refer to something called The Tragedy of the Commons, which is a book which came out in the 1970s, and which is a bit of a fallacy, really, because it wasn't a tragedy. There were all sorts of what were called stints, that is, rules as to what you could do and what you couldn't do on the common. And even the Lord of the Manor or a local baron would be fined if he had too many sheep on the common. So the reason that there's a tragedy of the commons has happened is because those rules have been slowly eroded.
Right. I mean, what about the enclosure in the modern day? I mean, the 1947 Town and Country Planning Act changed things, for example. I mean, how did that change things?
Well,
and where are we now?
Just after the Second World War, there were talks about nationalising all the land in Britain. But what they decided to do instead was to control development, that is, the planning system that we now have.
Mm.
Now, before that, people could pretty much do what they wanted on their land. That is to say, build a house, build a factory, do whatever they want. But now that's all been controlled. And it's a great source of controversy as to, you know, whether people are actually allowed to do what they want with their own piece of land that they've bought.
Okay, so enclosure is still a very relevant topic.
Well,
today.
It is, particularly in, say, for example, in Bristol city centre. We've got Cabot Circus and we've also got the galleries. These are privatised, enclosed city streets that used to be patrolled by the police. They're now patrolled by private security. So enclosure, unfortunately, is still alive and well.
Okay, well, Tony Gosling, thank you very much for coming in. And if you're interested in the issues discussed here, there are several good books and a magazine about land too.
Thanks, John.
Christopher Hill's book, The World Turned Upside Down, for example, is about the levellers and the diggers in the 17th century English Civil War. The book, This Land Is Our Land, by Marion Shord, which is S-H-O-A-R-D, another example, looks at the history of land privatisation or enclosure in Britain. And finally, the magazine that I mentioned comes out twice a year and is edited and published from a farm near South Petherton in Somerset. And it's called The Land, simply, and you can describe on the web www.tlio.org.uk/chapter7. That's the word chapter and the number 7 with no gaps. Or simply use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, to find Chapter 7, The Land magazine. TV channels have been multiplying at a dramatic rate over the last 15 years, you may have noticed, as have the number of different platforms, such as Sky, Virgin and Freeview. With all the channels now available, it's surprising that cinemas are still surviving at all. But is this really about choice, or is it just an illusion of choice, with dumbed-down documentaries, unfunny comedy, and soap plotlines bankrolled by a handful of super-rich corporations? Bristol's IMAX cinema in the At Bristol Centre has had to close because it was too expensive to run. But the White Ladies Road Picture House was forced to close, so they could put it on the market by owners Odeon, even though it was making money. Odeon put what's called a restrictive covenant on the building, trying to make sure it could never be used as a cinema again. And whilst it's a listed building, it's been an empty shell now for many years. The last manager of the White Ladies Picture House has moved on to pastures new, and with her husband, she's now running one of Bristol's only independent cinemas, near the Downs at Henley's. Tony Gosling caught up with her last week.
My name is Anne Miles. I am the manageress of the Orpheus Cinema, Henley's in Bristol. We are surrounded by the multiplexes, but we do quite a few different kind of films. This is a small, independent, cosy cinema. This week on the silver screen, this is on every Tuesday, and this week, Tuesday the 23rd of February, we'll be showing Creation, which is a PG certificate.
So these are films over the last few years that have done very well, maybe people didn't see at the time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, and what about the director's chair?
Well, the director's chair is fortnightly every Sunday, and on Sunday the 28th of February, the Mark of an Angel, which is a 12A certificate.
And what others have you got coming up in the Silver Screen and the Director's Chair in the next few weeks?
Well, the Silver Screen, you've got The Time Traveller's Wife, The Proposal, Coco Before Chanel, Bright Star, Julie and Julia, all very popular films, which maybe, you know, people have missed and really would like to see again. And the Director's Chair, Before the Rains, that's a 12A certificate. Conversations with My Gardener, that's a 12A certificate. Those are some which will be coming up.
Now, also, you were saying that you have a special Jewish film on.
Yeah,
now, how often do you do those?
Well, we do those once a month, every month, for the Jewish community, and that's the Divar. And this week we shall have the Divar presents Tovarich, I Am Not Dead. This is a 15 certificate, and this will show at 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 24th of February.
Now, you're really only a very small cinema compared to the others, most of the others around the city. How do you survive?
The people have been coming here for years. We get really good support from around this area. Also, the students and families as well. So, you know, we do cater for everyone.
How can you compete with all these TV channels, Sky, Virgin and goodness knows what else? Because people have to come out into the cold this time of year anyway and trek up here. How can you compete with the TV?
Well, customer service is very, very important. And also, you know, everyone plays their part, all the staff, the projectionists. So between us, we do have a good team. We do a special student price, which is £3 every show and any show. Adults are £4.60. Senior citizens are £3.60. Also, that's the children's price. And like I've just said, students all the time, just £3.
Can you just tell us whereabouts you are?
We're in Northumbria Drive, which is in between Waitrose and opposite the library and the Westbury Tavern.
Okay, final question. I've just remembered what I was going to ask you. How come it is that we have so few films made in Britain nowadays, and most of the films we show and you show and everybody shows, the new films being made, are mostly from America or from abroad somewhere?
I've got a friend that used to come to our house when my boys were small, and his name's Kirk Jones. He's now a director, and he came from Long Ashton. He did direct two films, actually, Waking Ned and Nanny McPhee. And I do believe now he's made a new one, which is called Everyone's Fine, which stars Robert De Niro. And I'm sure, you know, that will be a good one to show for everyone to see.
So British talent isn't completely dead yet. It's not all just Hollywood nowadays.
No, certainly not.
That was the manageress of the family-run Orpheus Cinema in Henleys, Anne Miles there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And you can find the Orpheus Henleys on the web at www.scottcinemas.co.uk, and that's Scott with two T's, like Scott of the Antarctic. scottcinemas.co.uk, and click on Bristol or phone up to hear a recording of current films on 08712 303 200. This is a higher rate phone number. Calls cost 10 pence a minute from a BT landline, and the cost of mobiles, of course, may vary. You may well have missed it, but at the end of last year, Jack Straw decided that magistrates would no longer have to declare their membership of the Freemasons' Secret Society when applying to join the bench. Last week, we heard from Jerry Coulter, a victim of Masonic corruption, and we hear part two of him chatting. Originally, the incoming Labour government made declaration of Masonic interests compulsory in 1998. So what's changed? Jerry Coulter speaks.
Now, I understand also that there's quite a proliferation of Freemasons in Westminster around Victoria Street and Scotland Yard and even the House of Commons and Parliament itself.
Well, Parliament's got, as far as we know, two Masonic lodges in Parliament. I don't know if that's from the lower house and the upper house, but there's certainly the existence of two Masonic lodges within Westminster itself.
Now, does that mean that the Freemasons are actually meeting in a lodge room or a temple within the Houses of Parliament?
That I wouldn't know, but what I do know is that just down the road from the Houses of Parliament, if you go down Victoria Street, past New Scotland Yard, on the left-hand side is a square, St James Square, and the lodge, Manor of St James, meets in the Masonic Hall on St James Square.
All of the lodges that the Freemasons are in have got numbers, haven't they? What do they signify?
Well, the lower numbers are the oldest lodge. For example, two-digit lodges would have probably been maybe 400 or 500 years old. They would have been the earliest lodges. Lodge 137, Amity Pool, is Dorset's oldest lodge. And in the Masonic yearbook that I got hold of, they celebrated their bicentenary in the 1970s. So that gives you an idea how old that lodge is. Some of the other lodges, a two-digit lodge will be a lot older, and therefore the Masons in those lodges are far more senior to Masons in a four- or five-digit lodge.
Now, the Freemasons have secret signs and handshakes. Is there any way you can recognise a Mason by the way they shake your hand or if they make a sign to you?
Yeah, again, if you go to Mason's Corner of our website, we've published a lot of the handshakes and the signs, various Masonic signs, that they have to show these signs, actually, to get a promotion up their various degrees within Lodge. And all this has been published on the website at Mason's Corner. For example, one is they will press the knuckles of your hand. They'll put their thumb across and they'll press either the first knuckle to show their initiated apprentice, the knuckle of your middle finger to show that they are craft level Freemasons, which most Masons are, or the third knuckle stretching right across your hand, which is to show a Master Mason. If it's a Master Mason shaking hands with you, he will not extend his hand towards you. If ever you get it's very unmistakable if you're given a handshake from a Master Mason. He will keep his hand in close to his body with his elbow bent. So you have actually got to extend your hand into his. And then he'll reach across and press your knuckle. If you're brethren, you will then... it's very hard for me to explain without a demonstration. If I was taking a handshake from a Master Mason who then pushes my third knuckle, I would then place my hand on his elbow, so forming a link and forming an angle corresponding to the angle of his arm with his elbow held in.
So you're using actually both arms to do that handshake. So
one is he would give me the handshake, pushing my knuckle, and I would then acknowledge by putting my hand upon his elbow, so forming...
That's the opposite hand, that's the left hand, on the
elbow. Of the
right
man
elbow,
the man giving the handshake, yeah.
Okay, so this is some interesting signs. What about language that's used? How can you recognise Masonic language? Or are there little terms?
Yeah,
I've heard one, for example, just after a meeting at the Bristol City Council to do with planning, one person talking to another in what I'd imagine was a Masonic language saying, let's not talk about this now, let's talk about it on the level.
Yeah, on the level is another Masonic word. The level, of course, and the square are Masonic tools and that are found in most Masonic lodges. They go back to the days when this was, of course, like the Masons were, if you like a trade union, the very earliest form of trade unions, where they had their lodgings in a hut where they were building castles and churches, and so therefore the tools were like the level or the square. I'm on the square, I'm on the level, have come down into basic Masonic dialogue. One of the ones that you should be aware of is when they're calling for Masonic support, which happened once in Dorset with the appointment of a deputy chief constable called May. He at his appointments meeting, he used the word, "I was taught to be cautious," when he was asked the question. And one councillor who had been married to a Royal Arch Mason severely objected to this, in that using the term "I was taught to be cautious" is a way of, it's a signal to the calling for Masonic support from other Masons in the room.
So if you suspect someone of being a Freemason, is there something you can say to them where if they're a Mason they'll acknowledge that or reply in a particular way?
What will happen is that he was saying, "I'm a Freemason," to those in the room, having never seen those people on the police authority. It was only the fact that one councillor made a big issue of it at the time. She complained about it, not that it did any good, because she knew "I was taught to be cautious" is a Masonic sounding. It's calling for Masonic support. They are also published at Mason's Corner of my website. There's also the Masonic hailing signal, the Masonic distress signal. There's all these signals that they give. Quite often, if a Mason wants to show he's a Mason, for example, to a magistrate, there'll be a lot of coughing and clearing of the throat to draw attention, and he will have put his right heel into the instep of his left foot, so standing square, And this standing posture is one of the Masonic postures. Again, it's on my website. You'll be able to see it.
Okay. Just remind us finally of that actual website address where we can find your Mason's Corner.
It's www.dorsetvictimsupport.org.
That was Jerry Coulter there, and thank you very much for his time. He was a victim of Masonic corruption, and Dialect's Tony Gosling asked him about secret Masonic lodges and handshakes. Okay, as ever, I'd like to introduce the Bard of Windmill Hill, Mr. Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hello again, John.
Okay, what have you got for us this week?
Well, this week we have The Price of Art. This is about somebody called Dame Liz Forgan, who was the chair of the Arts Council. And she made a visit from London to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And that was Stratford-upon-Avon. And then afterwards she took a taxi home, which cost the taxpayer £431.
Right.
Which is a little bit excessive, really.
Could have taken the train, really.
A little bit. Mm. So, yeah, it's just the price of art. It's not very nice to be cruel and snide, but when leaders exploit their expenses and take taxpayers' money for a ride, then you have to question where the sense is in giving perks to these Ponzi bosses to squander public funding far offside and leave artless folk to fund the losses. Do these arty people have any pride? At £400 for a taxi fare, does this artful dame think this is all right? If this is art, we all deserve a share of free taxi rides on a moonlit night.
There's a romantic image.
Are we allowed to clap?
Yeah, of course we're allowed to clap. It's the Bard of Windmill Hill.
Thank you.
Oh. Trevor Carter, thank you very much, and we look forward to many more.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Okay, well, it's time for the What's On Guide. Jeff is not with us, but instead we have Engineer Johnny. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 24th of February, and Europe will be performing with support from Diamond Head at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17 in advance. Moving on to Thursday, 25th of February, and there is the Midnight Carnival at the South Bank Club in Dean Lane, Bristol. Expect skittles, carnival games and performances from the Bohemian Embassy, Bert Miller and the Animal Folk, Not Now Bernard and also Ray. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 before 10 p.m. and £4 after. On Friday, 26th of February, the Thunder Bridge Bluegrass Boys will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £2 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Blackmore's Night. This group formed in 1997 and to date have released 7 studio albums and 2 live albums. The group is led by Richie Blackmore of Deep Purple fame and his wife Candice Knight. This song is from Fires at Midnight album and is a cover of the Bob Dylan track, The Times They Are A-Changin'.
Later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, 'cause the
That was Blackmore's Night with The Times They Are A-Changing from the album Fires at Midnight. For more information, you can check out www.blackmoresnight.com. Into Saturday 27th of February, and there is a night of local unsigned talent featuring Falling Into Difference, Teller, and also Keynes at The Tunnels at Bristol and Exeter Mews, near Temple Mead Station, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 27th of February, Fat, Drunk and Stupid will be performing at The Reckless Engineer, which is near to Temple Mead Station, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Saturday 28th of February, Kevin Figgs will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Johnny, and a band called Fat, Drunk and Stupid. Sounds great. Can't wait. In previous weeks, eagle-eared listeners will have noticed that the name Thomas Chatterton has come up. We had Michael Doble, who's the president of the Thomas Chatterton Society. He was here to chat about the poet, who lived a very long time ago, hundreds of years ago, and was considered the purest writer in the English language by none less than John Keats. Well, his house in Bristol, right opposite St Mary Redcliffe Church, is in danger of falling into disrepair. There's lots of weeds in the gardens, lots of potential for it, and the Thomas Chatterton Society has decided they want to put new life into this house and its garden so that it could be used by the general public and we can celebrate this man's legacy, because the council aren't really doing very much about it. Absolutely nothing at all, basically. So if you kind of want to find out a little bit more about that and how you can get involved in saving this man's house, which is just this little odd little house just as you go towards the Temple Mead Station on your left, right opposite the church there, go to Google or your favoured search engine and search for the Thomas Chatterton Society, and you can go and find out more there. We've got little membership forms here on paper, but if you want to write and find out more, you can also write to Dr. Daniel Cook, who's the membership secretary for the Thomas Chatterton Society, and his address is the School of English at the University of Bristol, number 1 Woodland Road, BS8 1TB, and it's £5 for a year, and please get involved. And if you happen to be walking past there, you will in fact find a little rack with membership forms slotted in, so you can just walk up to the house and take one and then go away with it. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 9 every Saturday evening and repeated at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can always listen live on the internet to bcfm.org.uk. Thank you to our various guests, Barbara and Sean, Barb Drummond, Sharon Locke, Kerry McCarthy and Trevor Carter, the Bard at Windmill Hill, of course. Our reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Atia Page, and the studio production was by Johnny Royden and Cam Moulton. The producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a radio co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or you'd just like to come along and check out the show being made, then please do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Collin, wishing you a very good week from all the team here in the Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for your company, and until next week, goodbye. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.